Will you turn to the third one, Calvin, the professor? And basically, I'm not going to follow the outline, but you can look at it and see what I'm not doing. I'd like to change the order a little bit and begin with Calvin, the professor outside of Geneva, and then focus on Calvin in Geneva. Calvin was a theologian, a minister of the gospel, but in fact he also was a teacher or a professor to basically the whole world. And that's what I'd like to spend the first few minutes reflecting on this evening. We've talked about his first publication in 1532, which was not really a religious writing, but in 1536, Calvin wrote the first edition of the Institutes, which was a small handbook of the Christian faith. And what I'd like to focus on this evening was how Calvin functioned as a teacher or as a professor outside of Geneva, particularly through his writings, the Institutes, commentaries, and some of the polemical tracts and treatises. The Institutes came out in 1536, and I think we can plainly say that it's not a very mature writing, and it's okay. He's born in 1509, this is 1536, he's not very mature. But in 1539, the second edition of the Institutes came out, and something is very different between 1536 and 1539. Between the beginning of his ministry, beginning in 1536 and 1539, there's a commentary on the book of Romans. And it was Calvin's intense work on Romans that produced the change in the second edition of the Institutes between 1536 and 1539. So that if you look at the second edition of the Institutes, which you can buy as a separate English copy, at least it used to be available, the format is much more similar to the 1559, the final edition of the Institutes. And the reason why it's so similar is because as Calvin understood Paul's theology in Romans, he finally understood how theology should be written. And Calvin begins the 1539 Institutes with the principle that he'll continue until 1559, coming from the book of Romans. And Calvin put together in a way that, well, was unique in Christian history. The two foundation chairs for a proper theology and, I would say, for a mature Christian world and life view. He begins the Institutes by telling us that there are two things necessary for us to know anything. Now, if you like philosophy, that could also be a philosophical statement. To know, the study of how we know, requires certain things. I mean, how do you know that the sun will rise tomorrow? Well, how do you know? Well, because it rose yesterday, right? But no, you know that there's more to knowing when the sun will rise than knowing that it happened yesterday. So Calvin, by looking at what Paul had to say in Romans, began to realize certain things. First of all, in Romans 1, Paul says that all men who are created in the image of God have within them something that's innate, an innate knowledge, an internal knowledge, a knowledge that, for example, if you came to Christ as an adult, you knew before you came to Christ that, in fact, God existed. Now, again, I don't want testimonies. Testimonies are great. But all men and women, Paul tells us in Romans 1:18, know that God exists. And what do they do with that knowledge? Go ahead. They suppress it in unrighteousness. So Calvin begins the Institutes with a twofold knowledge. To know anything, you need to know who you are, and you need to know who God is. And as he begins to develop the Institutes, he says, we need to know that God created the heavens and the earth. And basically, he put us in his playground, and you play in his playground by his rules. If you break his rules, guess what happens? You get punished. So, who are we? We are creatures created in the image of God. And who is God? God is the creator of the heavens and the earth. And for those who love Christ, he's also the one whom we can call Father. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Well, if you understand that, then those two big fat books are understandable. That's the foundation for the entire institutes. And we see that first in the 1539. So he's 30 years old. Now he's mature enough to have a real mature theology. He's the ripe old age of 30 when he has this figured out. So the institutes continue. And if you do a study of the institutes, that's what I'm supposed to do. You do a study of it, and you'll see that there's a relationship between Calvin's commentaries and the Institutes. So the different editions of the Institutes grow. It's because, he just did Isaiah. And guess what? The Institutes just grew by 5% because of all these Isaiah footnotes. He just did something on Hebrews. Well, guess what? There's all this. So you see this symbiotic relationship between his commentaries and the development in the Institutes. So that's how the Institutes came together, and the Institutes have been in print since the very first time. So they were first done in Latin, then they were translated by Calvin into French, and before the end of his life, it was in English and German and basically all the languages, and it's been translated into almost every known language. It's one of the books, for example, Dave's interest in China. It's been in Chinese and Mandarin for a very long time, at least in abridgments. So the Institutes have been very popular. And believe it or not, one of the most popular portions of the Institutes is a book that you may have heard of. Have you ever heard of the Golden Booklet of the Christian Life? Guess what that is? It's just the Institutes. And people think that some English Puritan wrote it. And it's like people do it for devotions and devotional stuff. So if you want to trick people to like Calvin, give them the Golden Booklet of the Christian Life, and it's anonymous, and they'll say, this is really good. And then smile and say, yeah, it's Calvin's Institutes. You just did Calvin's Institutes as part of your family devotions. So that's a trick. It may not be in print, but if it's in print, try to get a copy of the Golden Booklet of the Christian Life. So that's the Institutes, and they've been teaching believers for the centuries. Well, I hope maybe we'll have some time for questions on that. Likewise, Calvin wrote many biblical commentaries, and the commentaries come out of his work as a professor. But his work as professor was really kind of complex. First of all, if you're Presbyterian, you have what's called presbyteries. And if you're a presbyter, going to presbytery meetings is one of your favorite things to do 3 times a year about, right? Well, if you're in Calvin's Geneva, you had presbytery meeting basically once a week. So what they did, because they didn't have presbyteries, is all the ministers, there were 5 ministers in the city of Geneva, and then there were about another 5 ministers in the villages around. See, Geneva was what we call a city-state. So you had the city and then the countryside around that. So every week, the ministers would come together, and each week, somebody would expound the scriptures for the other ministers, and then the other ministers would critique their exposition. So many of Calvin's commentaries came from these exposition times when Calvin was expounding the scriptures for the other members of the Geneva consistory, the Geneva session. And by the way, for those of you who are ruling teaching elders, you were only allowed to do it from the Greek and Hebrew text. It doesn't matter, even if you're the little country preacher, you still had to be able to do it from the Greek and Hebrew text. So a lot of the commentaries came from that, but many of the commentaries also came from what we'll call the Academy. But in fact, it can't be just from the Academy, because the Academy is actually established in 1559. Calvin's dead in 1564. So most of the commentaries came from earlier times, either these kinds of pastoral expositions or changes from the sermons. And then finally, Calvin wrote some polemical tracts and treatises. And once again, I don't know that they're in print. They've usually been in print, but usually they're gathered together in 3 volumes. So there's 3 volumes of these theological tracts that Calvin wrote. And Calvin's opinion was sought by theologians with almost all the difficult, thorny stuff. So there are tracts by Calvin on free will, on predestination, on the nature of the Trinity, on what happens to the soul after death. Tracts on important and less important issues relative to the Lord's Supper and important things in the church and theological, small problems. And people from all over the world would ask for his opinion, and they would be published in these different tracts. So Calvin was a professor from Geneva, was sending out these books, the institutes, the commentaries, and the polemical tracts and treatises. They were translated into all the modern languages, even while Calvin was still alive. So he was a professor for the people of God while he was ministering in Geneva. So with that behind us, let's take a look at the first part and understand what happened in Geneva and Calvin and the educational reforms that occurred because of the Reformation. Well, this afternoon we had a breakout session, and we looked at American Christian education, which was a helpful big picture. I'd like to take a smaller look at what happened in Geneva and begin with Calvin's first time of ministry in Geneva. And something happened in Geneva that there's very, we Americans like to have the biggest, here's the biggest, hot dog in America, and here's the biggest ice cream cone, or the biggest watermelon. Texas has the biggest, everything. And we like to have the biggest and the best, or the first. We like to be the oldest school, or the first this or that. Well, there's actually a first in all of Western history that happened in Geneva during the ministry of Calvin, and that was, you ready? Dun-dun-dun-dun. Women were educated. For the first time in all of Western history, the city of Geneva, at public expense, trained women to read. For 1,000 years, women were not trained. Now, the noble women could learn to read, but never, never in all of Western history had this happened. And it was really strange when we lived in Grand Rapids, when I was at Calvin Seminary and had this this research place called the Meter Center for Calvin Studies. People would come and want to do research projects. And I kept getting letters from people. I had an affectionate name for them. They're called feminazis. These were women who were not believe. I mean, they weren't believers. I mean, they could care less about Christianity, and I mean, they were Marxist feminist stuff, and they wanted to come to Grand Rapids. And I kept thinking, why do you want to? And it was this groundbreaking work with women, and they wanted to be, the first in the field to. So in fact, we had these people, these different kinds of people, studying Calvin's view of women, and it was fascinating. So let me tell you. Can I tell you the story? So here's the story. Even if you don't want it, I'm going to tell you the story anyway. And if you'd like to know more about it, there's an article in the Archiv für Reformationsgeschichte that I wrote about it. That's a German thing, but the article's in English. And it's Calvin and women in the book of Genesis. And what Calvin did in his Genesis commentary, which came out late in his life, is that he's in a running debate with Martin Luther. Except his Genesis commentary is kind of small. It's about this thick. But compared to Luther's is 7 volumes. So it's actually kind of small. And in Calvin's Genesis commentary, he's engaging with Luther, but he doesn't mention his name. So he says, well, some scholars say, with no foundation. And then I'll have this quotation, and it's exactly word for word Martin Luther, but he doesn't say it's Martin Luther. And Calvin argues in the Genesis commentary that Eve is, while she is made from Adam's body, she is equally the image of God. And to be honest, I studied every Genesis commentary that was published before Calvin. He's the first one to say that. He took on, and the German Lutherans just thought this was idiotic. I mean, they, and Luther had some interesting things to say. And I mean, nobody thought he was right. So from his theology, the theology was put in practice in Geneva. And that's really one of the things that I want to talk about. Theology wasn't some sterile thing for Calvin. So if a woman is fully the image of God, which we all accept, this is true. Calvin was right. Everybody's now accepted that. And it's because Calvin was willing, I mean, he took brutal criticism for his views. If women are in the image of God, guess what? They have the right to learn to read. Now, Luther, for example, was convinced that you couldn't teach women to read. He says, wait a minute, women are made for babies? This is really, you can't, I have never met a woman who could read, he said. I don't know what, his wife was nice too, I'm sure, but I guess she couldn't read. So Geneva started to train women. And when I talk about later about the curriculum of the school in Geneva, there were girls there for the first time in European history. So that's a little bit about how theology relates to praxis, how he put his money literally where his mouth was relative to education. And again, the father of five daughters, yay, Calvin. Women, you are in the image of God. And you can learn to read. Okay. So let's talk about the changes. As soon as Calvin and Farel came in, they wanted education. But as in the breakout lecture, the emphasis was made, and rightly, that here in the United States, reading and writing in ciphers was basically so that people could read the scripture. And as Calvin and Farel began in Geneva, they tried to get what we would call general public education so that people could learn to read. Now, that doesn't seem very strange to us, but the official Roman Catholic teaching is it is dangerous to read the scripture. It is prohibited. You may not read the scripture in the Roman Catholic Church in the 16th century. It's forbidden. And by the way, you could be ordained a priest and still not know how to read. It's true. You had to be able to memorize the Latin Mass. You did not, reading was not a requirement for the priesthood. You could be illiterate and still be ordained, but that's strange, but it's true. So, and nobody read. Nobody knew how to read, and Calvin and Farel wanted the people to learn how to read, specifically to read the scripture. But by the time he came back into his, for the second time, beginning in 1541, Calvin began thinking about a plan for what we would call universal education in Geneva, and we're going to see how different it was in Geneva than in the United States. So a school is established in the 1550s. Calvin was not able to pull this off for the first 10 years of ministry at all, and it's true that when he was in Strasbourg, there was a very good school system already established there. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the structure and the faculty and the size of the Genevan Academy. So beginning in 1551, it starts to move, but it's actually not until 1559 that everything is signed, sealed, and delivered. And during the breakout session, it was mentioned that there were seven grades in the public school of Geneva. And the public school the students weren't admitted before the age of nine. So you began public school at the age of nine, and there were seven grades that you could pass, and you could do it every year. But as you'll see in just a minute, there's a certain amount of curriculum that you had to pass before you were permitted to go to the next grade. So while education was to be provided for all, unlike John Dewey America, education was only provided up until the point that you couldn't handle it anymore. In other words, as long as you could keep progressing, it was to be yours, and it was to be free. And brothers and sisters, this was socially revolutionary. This was very strange. Let me explain. In Europe, during Calvin's time, there were still very strong class structures. Now, we Americans don't like class structure. Calvin believed that class structures were divinely ordained. So, for example, there were about 7 different recognizable class structures in Geneva, starting with the magistrate, especially the mayor, moving down to hired servants. And as a matter of fact, yes, it's true. In Calvin's Geneva, you had to dress according to your class structure. So it's not like he's democratic, you know, everybody's the same in terms of recognizing class structure. But Calvin was very revolutionary when he permitted the children of the scullery maid to have a complete and full education, the same as the noble son. So class structure was not abolished, but opportunity for education was given unilaterally to everyone, and the noble son had to pass exams and wasn't automatically bumped up, and the housekeeper's son could be advanced beyond, say, the nobleman's son. So this was revolutionary, and it took a lot of fighting in Geneva for this to be passed in the academy. So there were 2 schools, the private school and the public school, and Calvin hired 4 guys full-time right away to come, and their only job was to teach, and all of this was to be paid from the tax dollars of the city of Geneva. So this guy, Theodore Beza, was the head of this little school. There was a full-time professor of Hebrew and Hebrew studies. There was a full-time professor of Greek and Greek studies, and then there was a full-time professor of the arts. So 4 full-time faculty members in the Geneva Academy. And the school started in the first year with 280 students in the first grade. That is the, you know, what we would call the first grade, the baby grade of the 7 grades of school. By the time Calvin died, the school, what was called the public school, had 1,200 students. Now, the whole city only had 15,000. So this was almost a 10% addition in terms of numbers. It was very big. And then there'll be a second school called the Geneva Academy that's now the University of Geneva, and it only had 300 students, so it's a lot smaller. So the school began, the kid was around 9, maybe 8 or 9, and basically went to the age of 16. I'm sorry. And kids, here's your school year. That's 49 weeks a year. You're given 3 weeks of vacation, which coincide with the 3 weeks of grape harvest, so that you could leave school and go out to the fields and harvest the grapes. If you don't have the grapes, you don't have anything to drink. So you're given a generous 3 weeks of vacation to go work in the fields. And as was mentioned at the breakout session, in the summertime, when the sun was up, classes started at 6 a.m., and in the cold winter, you were allowed to sleep till 7 a.m. There was a half-hour break for breakfast, and then an hour and a half to 2 hours at lunchtime, because you have your main meal at noon in Switzerland in those days. So you had a nice, long, generous midday break. And then school went on to 4 o'clock. We're not sure that it was 6 days a week. Perhaps it was 6 days. I think it was actually only 4.5 days, except for the older kids, and they went 6 days. So here's the curriculum, and this is what many of you are parents, many of you have kids, and tonight I have notes because I'll mess it up if I try to do it from memory, because I'm going to give you names of things that I have no idea even what I'm talking about. I am not a classicist, so please don't ask me embarrassing questions like, have you read this? And I'll have to tell you, no, I haven't read it in Latin. I haven't read it in Greek. And I'm not always sure whether it's in Latin or Greek even, because it's very complex. So you start school, let's say you're 9 years old. And you're from Geneva, and you speak French as your mother tongue, but you don't know your alphabet. Mom and Dad do not know how to read and write. So in first grade, you learn your ABCs, your French ABCs. and you start those things in the first year called the seventh class. And then you'd also start to learn ABCs with Latin, the Latin ABCs, which were different from the French ABCs, like the, you know, the French have a C with a squiggle on the bottom that you don't have in Latin, and Latins have Fs that look like Ss that you don't have in French. So you'd have to learn the different things. By the second grade, can I just switch to the Geneva? So it's backwards. So our first grade is their seventh grade. So they go backwards, 7, 6, 5. So like if you're the big stuff, you're in grade 1 instead of like in America. So I'm going to do it Geneva style. So 7 is 1 and 1 is 7. So if you're in seventh grade, you start to learn some basic grammar of Latin and French. Sixth grade, you begin to write and learn more grammar. In the fifth grade, you start learning formal syntax, both in French and in Latin, and you begin Latin composition. So you're now starting to write Latin sentences in the fifth grade. In the fourth grade, you know all the syntax and meter. You start to read Cicero's letters in Latin, and Ovid's elegies, Ovid's Trista, Ovid's De Ponto, and I don't know what they are. And guess what? You also began in the fourth class, you began studying Greek. Then you go to the third class. How old are you now? You started at 9, so you're up to the third class of 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. So 9 and 5, you're about 14. So in the third class, you continue your work in Greek, but by now you're reading in Latin Cicero's letters, Cicero's De Amicitia. You're reading stuff in both Greek and Latin. You're reading Virgil's Aeneid and Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic War. You're now reading Greek texts. It's Isocrates' Pyrrhonic orations. And again, some of you may be classicists, and I don't know what they are. So these are grades 1 through are the first 5 grades. And here's what I want to say. Brothers and sisters, this is the public grade school. And why would they learn like Greek in the public grade school? I mean, this seems high level, doesn't it? Well, it's going to get worse. In the second class, so you're next, you know, you're junior in high school, sort of. The second class for sure meets 6 days a week. They meet on Saturdays. And by that time, you're reading the Gospel of Luke in Greek. And in your first, and as your senior year, the first class, you read all of the epistles and the Acts of the Apostles in Greek before you graduate. But you've also been learning history. That's your junior year of high school or the second class. You've read a whole bunch of Latin. You're reading Greek history in Greek. You're reading Homer's poetry. You're reading logic in Latin and Greek. By the time you finish with this, this is the public school, you've completed all the works in logic. You've begun work in rhetoric. And by the time you're in your junior or senior year, your second or first class, you're analyzing Cicero, Demosthenes, Homer, Virgil for rhetorical flourish and the ability to communicate in very complex Latin and Greek, so that you have to be able to speak and write complex sentences in both of those languages. And that's the public school for boys and for girls that was free to everybody. Now, that's a little different from in Adam's fall, we sin at all. And tonight, I simply, I don't want to necessarily draw any conclusions. I just want to present to you this sort of different view of public education. And let's try to understand why it would be so advanced and so complex. And particularly in the last 2 years of, now this is not the academy. This is not training for ministers. This is the free public school for boys and girls. Now, by the way, again, there were exams. So you started Greek. And if you couldn't master Greek in 2 years, you're out. I mean, that's it. They're willing to pay for school. But if you're lazy or dumb, go sweet. It was tough. I mean, this is hard work. Think about this as a college student. This is daunting to me. This is intimidating to me. And these guys are 16 when they graduate. And this was to be not just for ministers, not just for the elite. This was Geneva's hope for all of their citizens. And remember the last mark of the church? Calvin wanted fruit in the lives of the people. What was the fruit that was hoped for in this curriculum? The end fruit of this very complex curriculum was this: men and women who can speak clearly, who can think clearly, who can argue persuasively, and who are capable of advanced communication. And what's necessary for a high level of society? Men and women who can speak clearly, think clearly, take ideas from here and over there, take them over to here to put feet on ideas, to be able to express ideas clearly, to articulate them. So logic and rhetoric were studied not because they were considered esoteric topics. It was to produce competent citizens who could intelligently debate issues of highest importance to the city. Now, doesn't that make sense? This is a good fruit of education. And I want to say one other thing, and you may choose to be critical. I'm just telling you what he did. The authors aren't Christian authors. The authors that they're studying are pagan Greek authors. It's not like they're just reading Greek Christian writings. These are what we call the classics. Whether you think that's good, whether you think that's bad, tonight my job is to just tell you what he did. And if you want to ask questions, I'm not here to defend Calvin, but I just want to explain what happened. Okay, so rhetoric and ability to communicate was the goal of this public school. Now, with a few minutes left, I want to talk about the Academy of Geneva, the school that trained you after the school. And the Academy of Geneva started with 162 students, and it was 3 years, and there were no grades. In other words, you started, and you stayed there 3 years, and they just kind of went in a circle. So like with the seminary, we say, well, you're in your first year, your second year, your third year, and that's true. But like if you begin your first year in year A, we've got courses A, courses B, courses C, and then the next year we start A, B, and C. So it doesn't really matter when you start, whether it's year C or year B or year A. We go through the whole thing 3 years, and that's what the academy did. And during the academy, the school year was the same, but there were 27 hours required per week for someone who goes to the academy. And who went to the academy? Well, many people think that it was a training ground just for ministers. The Academy of Geneva was not established as a seminary. Let me say it again. It wasn't established as a seminary. Well, wait a minute. I mean, I thought Geneva trained ministers. It did. But for Calvin, the highest office in the land was not the office of minister. It was the magistrate. And Calvin wanted the magistrate, the city officials, to have this training, not just ministers. So first of all, for all the school students, there was, as was mentioned in the breakout this afternoon, a profession of faith. Calvin said the only people who can be well educated are believers. So you had to be you have to be a believer. You have to sign this confession of faith, mandated worship. You had to go to church twice on Sunday. You had to go to Wednesday evening church. There were special services for the students. So if you went to the academy, you had these 27 hours a week. And again, it started at 6 a.m. Their day was a little bit longer. Whether it was winter or summer, it began at 6 a.m. And their day went till 5 p.m. There were 3 hours a week of lectures in theology, but there was also 3 hours a week in physics and mathematics. There were 5 hours a week in dialectic and rhetoric. This is Calvin's Geneva Academy. Oh, by the way, there were 8 hours a week in Hebrew. Hebrew. For 8 hours a week, only 3 hours in Greek. No, I'm sorry, 5 hours in Greek. And all of the Greek instruction was non-biblical Greek. Do you know why? They already knew the Bible. This is the hard Greek. So, Bible Greek's easy Greek. We're going to give you 5 hours a week for 3 years of the hard Greek, and you're going to read like everything in Greek so that when you get to Koine, this is easy stuff. So, 5 hours in Greek, 3 in physics and math, 5 in dialectic and rhetoric, 3 hours a week in ethics, 8 hours in Hebrew and Old Testament, and just 3 hours in theology. So, why so much rhetoric? Why physics? For Calvin, physics was something that ministers should study as well as magistrates. What part of God's creation is not under the rule and reign of Jesus Christ? Physics is Christ's. And the magistrate, as well as the preacher, has to know how to speak clearly, communicate clearly. So this was beyond what I consider to be a pretty massive, the primary education. This went way beyond. So theology was 3 days a week at least, lectures from Calvin and Beza. Then on Saturdays, I think it was just the theology students. I'm sure it's just the theology students. On Saturday, each of the students of the academy, each student, each Saturday, had to spend 1 hour expounding Scripture from the Greek Bible. And then once a month, each theology student had to stand before the faculty and his colleagues to do an oral defense of certain theological propositions. You had to stand there and get grilled. You stood there until he told you to sit down. So Calvin said this: one learned to teach. One learned to teach. He said that the ultimate objective of every human being in Geneva, every human being who's a Christian, should be to understand the Scriptures. And that's got to be the ultimate objective in life for everyone. So they worshiped together. They lived together. And they studied together. And it was a little bit different, and that's what I wanted to present tonight. Calvin, the professor, revolutionized Western education. It was never, ever the same after that time. And whether you think it's good or whether you think it's bad, that if we have a question and answer time, I'm sure you'll have some opinions, because everybody's been through school, and I'd like to hear. Will we have Q&A at all? Okay, but I was supposed to stop like 4 minutes ago, right? Okay, so that's my stuff. Would you like to ask questions? Dave, would you moderate? Because I don't know who everybody is, and it's nice if you run interference in case somebody starts screaming at me or something. I don't know.
I'm going to break it open to beyond tonight's lecture. Are there, and some of you did not, you weren't able to get to the lunch today where we did formal questions and answers. Any questions for Dr. Gamble on the life or ministry or contribution of Calvin? And we'll just take a few minutes to see if we can field a few questions, and then we'll get on to our reception time. Roger Mann.
Yes. The lecture hall is still operative. So this last summer I got to lecture in Calvin's lecture hall, and it was about the third the size of this room. And it was like stony, so you really didn't need too big a voice to be able to project. So the groups were pretty small in terms of the academy. Yeah, the pulpit is really up high, and it has a soundboard on the top, and you have to project, and he got hoarse. Yeah, as a matter of fact, Calvin preached twice on Sunday mornings, the same sermon twice, at dawn and at 9 o'clock, the magistrates asked Calvin to produce yet another sermon. Oh yes, thank you. Yet another sermon for the evening, which he was able to do for a year, but it killed his health. So after a year, they said, "Okay, you don't have to do that anymore. So you only have to preach twice on Sunday in this massive cathedral with a very loud voice."
Jim.
Yes. I hope they're still in print. Baker's kept them available.
Yeah, there used to be a little 7-volume set, which was tracts and letters. I think three
and four.
Earlier, 3 volumes are tracts, and then his personal letters, which are just a really edifying read, seeing all of his correspondence. Yeah, Lenny.
Calvin and Luther did not have a relationship. They never met each other. But they had a written relationship. And, of course, the issue was the Lord's Supper. So, would you like to hear the story? In 1529, in the city of Marburg, Germany, Philip of Hesse paid to have a delegation of Swiss people, which did not include Calvin, because Calvin probably wasn't even saved yet. But Zwingli and Bucer and some other names came up from Switzerland and went to Marburg, and Luther and Melanchthon and his guys came down to Marburg, and they had a 3-day discussion on church unity. Philip wanted to unite the two because he knew that the Catholics were going to try to kill them. So it's good to have the Swiss pikemen on your side as a German. And they developed a little-known confession of faith of 14 2/3 points. So Luther and Zwingli agreed on 14 theological points. And on point 14, there was A, B, and it was point C of 14 where they disagreed. And that was on the nature of the Lord's Supper. Luther holds to a view called consubstantiation concerning the elements. Zwingli said, no, Jesus can't be in with around the Lord's Supper because he's seated in heaven. At that point, and this is... This was really a sad thing for me. Luther excommunicated Zwingli and said, you're going to hell and your teaching is from the devil, and refused the right hand of fellowship from that moment forever. So in 1563, we have what's called the Heidelberg Catechism, which was written by Germans who believed what Calvin taught, and they were trying to, please don't kill us anymore. So 1529, Marburg, no possible union between the Lutherans and the Swiss. I mean, Zwingli broke down and cried. I mean, he got on his knees and said, you're joking, right? And Luther said, you are full of the devil. And there were stenographers. They took down every word. There's a 3-volume stenographic record. The typists were there. No, they did it by hand. So Calvin was able to modify Zwingli's view, and Melanchthon, Luther's right-hand man, who was at this conference, agreed with Calvin. So Calvin wrote this real long explanation of the Lord's Supper in a letter to Martin Luther and gave it to Melanchthon, his friend, to give to Luther, his friend, and then Luther died. And Calvin writes to Melanchthon and says, excuse me, Mr. Melanchthon, but why didn't Luther get my letter? And we have the letter back from Melanchthon to Calvin saying, I'm sorry, but I just couldn't take another beating. It was a violent time, and Luther had a violent temper and would beat Melanchthon until he actually bled you disagreed with him and he would like punch you out. And so he said, I just couldn't take another beating. So that letter was never delivered. Any other questions?
Please no.
Calvin's one child, his own child died. He had two stepchildren. And basically, I don't know. The stepdaughter left the faith, ran away with a seminary student. And there's no record of them. They were expelled from Geneva. The son, as far as we know, just lived a normal life. He was a good boy, but I just don't. He wasn't historically important.
There was a little bit more extensive answer in the question and answer time that I believe was taped at lunch. Did we tape lunch? No?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So that you might check that out. Oh, Amy.
I thought
you had problems. I know
you mentioned
it. Calvin?
Yeah.
You know, I went to a conference once, and a physician did an entire hour-long session on Calvin's ailments. And it was done by a physician who was sympathetic, and he could explain things that, like, so Calvin had gout, and Calvin had kidney stones. And you want to hear, okay, here's a letter from Calvin to his physician. Dear Mr. Physician, thank you for your prescription concerning my kidney stones. You prescribed horseback riding so that it would jiggle things out. But I just want to tell you that my hemorrhoids are so bad that the pain of the hemorrhoids is worse than the kidney stones. So there's something else you can prescribe. It's true. That's a real letter. He died of tuberculosis. And what's fascinating is this notion from the first lecture of Calvin being a dead man walking. He was so weak in his body, it was time for him to preach on Sunday, and he literally had them carry him from bed on Sundays to preach. And, I mean, he had tuberculosis, and he's coughing up blood, and that's what spreads the tuberculosis. So he thought he was being faithful, and he's spreading the TB all over the place. So that's how he died.
You guys ready to eat? Why don't we let's end tonight singing? You know, there was a sad. The Lord did.